Russell.
Good evening. My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I want to congratulate all the birthday celebrants. That's great. And special congratulations to Jimmy and Dawn and everybody else. And also the guys with 30 days or less. That's a great deal, too. So it's a privilege to be here with this group. This is an enthusiastic group. I really... This is actually taped later on. That wasn't at me. You weren't whistling. I should say with this group, I hope it wasn't at me. You know, I can never be sure with you guys, you know. Keeping on my toes. I'm going to review a little, and we're going to get up to the eighth step, and then I was sitting with some, I just had an incredible dinner. Has anybody ever gone to, I'm going to put a plug into them, Kitchenetta? Yeah. Unbelievable. We had about 14 guys over there, and we ate like pigs. It was unbelievable. You know, and this has actually something to do with what I want to talk about tonight. Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, because I don't want you guys to miss the banquet. You know, I don't want you to miss the banquet. I don't want you to, you know, the AA banquet. I don't want you to be walking away from the banquet with a ham sandwich. And some guy saying, man, that lobster was incredible. And those stone crabs were unbelievable. And what about that sirloin steak? Have you ever tasted anything like that? And boy, the Italian food they had. And you're sitting there saying, what are you talking about? I got this lousy ham sandwich. And you say, well, what about, you didn't get the lobster, you didn't get the stone crab? You didn't get all the where'd they have it? He said, that huge buffet. I said, I didn't see any huge buffet. And he said, sure, they had it. And I don't want you to walk away from AA with a ham sandwich. I want you to do the buffet. You know, somebody was talking to me, came up to me, we were discussing it, and certainly we have atheists and agnostics in AA and things like that, and there's a whole chapter to the agnostics. And, you know, you can probably stay sober without having a relationship with God. Probably can. Probably been done. Probably guys with 20, 30, 40 years. And I know there are. I've heard them in rooms saying, I don't believe. My mother was in, and I loved my mother, and I thought she helped a lot of people. I want to tell you that. I think she helped a lot of people. And she started Free Thinkers. How's that for irony? She started Free Thinkers in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the atheist group in AA. And I love my mother, and I respect my mother. I respect her sobriety, actually. And but the fact of the matter is that, so I have no doubt you can be physically sober, even have some emotional or mental progress. I just don't believe you'll get what these guys got. I just don't believe. I mean, I believe this is like a book of, this is like a recipe. You know, and I you know, you follow the recipe, and you get the chocolate cake. These guys say in here, it says right here in the book, it says on page 25, you know, they map out what their experience is. They had no reason to lie. They didn't know where this book was going. This is their testimony. They said, we have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Now, you come to AA rooms all the time like I do. I say, how you doing? They say, hanging in there. One day at a time. You know, haven't had a drink today. And they say a million other different things. But I'm always looking for that guy who's being rocked, who says something that leads you to believe that this guy has found what they were talking about. Because that's what I want. I want to be hanging around for 14, 20, 30 years, getting on my deathbed and finding out that I walked away with a ham sandwich when I could have had stone crabs, because you look at me and tell I like to eat. Right? That's what I want. I want to have that vision. You know, the Bible says, where there is no vision, the people perish. You know, I want to have the real deal. The great fact is just this and nothing less. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and our lives in a way in which it is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. Later on, when it talks about the promises, that new freedom, new habits, it says we finally see that He is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. In Vision for You, it ends up, one of the last paragraphs says, see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. They talk about the great fact, the tremendous fact, in a million different ways, and they all talk about the same thing. They all talk about a relationship with God. And all these steps come down to either getting the relationship with God or improving your relationship with God. That's what they're all about. That's what the whole thing is about. You can water it around. You can water it down to your own purposes. If you don't like that, if you don't want to do it, if you don't want to believe it, you can kick it to the curb. You can do it your own way. You can do whatever you want to do, but don't tell me what the book says and what it doesn't say. And so I want to review a little bit about what the book says regarding this all the way up until we get to the eighth step, and then I want to talk about freedom. I want to talk about freedom. You know, I don't know, why would you talk about freedom in the eighth step? Well, maybe we'll get to that. Hopefully we'll get to that. I want to talk about the new freedom. It says, it doesn't start off with a promise. It says you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness, right? So what does that mean? I mean, how do you know whether you've got the new freedom? How do you know it's not like an old freedom or a freedom you used to have? You know, what do they mean by freedom? What are they talking about? How do you get that deal? So I want to read a few things, and I'm going to skip over some pages, and it's sometimes hard to pick out what you want to read in this thing, but there's a pattern here. I think there's a pattern here. Here we go, on page 28. This is going to go all through the steps, all through the chapters, until we finally get to step 8. What seemed at first a flimsy read has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 43 personal experiences. Each individual, you're talking about us, in the personal stories, this is my story, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's what it says. I'm not making this stuff up. Then you move on. We go past that. Let's go into, I don't know. And of course, throughout all these steps, they're talking about the relationship with God and all the book, all the pages, they're talking about that. But I'm just picking out a few. Then going into what we read all the time, what we read tonight, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. Make clear to most of us, to a lot of us, not to all of us, but they're supposed to be clear. Here's what makes it clear. Here's the three ideas that are clear. That we're alcoholics and we can't manage our own lives. That probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. But that God could and would if He were sought. And then it says, being convinced of this, being convinced of those three things. We're now at step 3. Prior to that, it says there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find Him now, which apparently isn't you. Because later on in this thing, because you got, you know, you can find yourself, just look in the mirror. But then later on it says this. This is the how and why. But first of all, we had to quit playing God. We're not God. God's going to be our director. He's the principal. We are His agents. He's the Father. We're His children. Most good ideas are simple. Simple, clear-cut, simple ideas. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. You got to pass through this arch in order to get to that new freedom and that new happiness. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. Tremendous things. You want remarkable things to happen. You want to go to that remarkable banquet. You don't want to go to like the ham sandwich banquet. Nothing wrong with ham sandwiches. But at least you want to have an option of going to the stone crab banquet. All sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer being all-powerful. Wow, apparently he's not even a higher power. He must be the highest power because he's all-powerful. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. See, all the only condition is you got to get close to him. How do you do that? How do you get close to him? And you got to do his work well. You know, not your own work, his work. How do you find out what his work is? I guess you got to get close to him. Find out what he wants you to do. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. We became conscious of his presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. Then it says the third step prayer, and it says we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. And now we're past step three, and we're sailing on over to step four, and we do step four, and all of a sudden we're in how it works, and it says perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, you know, everybody tossed around this word, well, I'm spiritual. Well, that's great, but you see, these people, when they talk about spirituality being spiritual, it was tied into a relationship with God. It wasn't like there is no God, but I'm just spiritual. It wasn't like a characteristic they had. I'm a spiritual person. No. Listen, if you're a spiritual person, then you don't have the same disease I had. I lived with myself for 31 years with this disease. I'm a bum. I'm a selfish, self-centered, wicked, evil bum. I know exactly what I did. Maybe I don't even know exactly what I did. I have a real sense now of what I did, how I acted, what my motives are. For me to tell myself, as I told myself for 31 years, as I was ripping people's hearts out, disappointing them, being self-centered, being irresponsible, for me to tell myself, well, I was just a good guy with a good heart, and I'm basically okay because I'm not as bad as Jack the Ripper, you know, and I'm not a serial killer, but I'm basically okay, misapprehends what I am. I'm not a spiritual person. Left to my own devices, I'll turn on you, and I'll say, who the hell do you think you are? You know, I'm a person, I'm a person, I'm a sick person, I have a disease of alcoholism, I'm an unspiritual person. My spirituality, whatever spirituality I have, and that is my interest in things that are non-material, my disinterest in myself springs from and is incorporated in and really depends upon and flows from my relationship with the God of my understanding and my faith. It's all tied in together. I can't separate my God and my belief from God, which saying I'm spiritual because I have tarot cards at home or I look at spheres or, you know, chant or something like that. It ties into a relationship. It ties into my humbling myself to the point where I understand who I am and what I am. I'm not the ruler of the universe. And being grateful for my sobriety because I didn't do it for myself. I owe that to somebody else, the grace of God. That's for me. It ties in that. And I believe it tied in with these people. That's why they're talking about it so much. Perhaps there is a better... It says, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages, the interesting thing is when they're saying this, we never apologize for anyone for depending upon our Creator. What do you think they're talking about? We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. What do you think they're talking about? They're talking about people who put you down because you talk too much or think too much about God. That's what they're talking about. He says, we don't apologize to those people. Paradoxically, it's a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. Then we're already into the fifth step now. And what does it say? Well, a lot of people think the fifth step is, well, it's a psychological thing. It probably has some psychological and emotional and all sorts of things that you can tie it into. But what does our big book say the purpose of it is? And now we're already in the fifth step. It says, and the fourth step, and this is what they're saying. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? Here you go. We have been trying. What have you been trying to do? Stay sober? Well, sure. You know, remain sober? Sure. Feel better? Yeah. But what have we really been trying to do? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We're trying to get a new, this is what they're saying, the main object of this is to get a new relationship with our Creator and discover the obstacles to that relationship that's in our path. That's what the point is of all these steps. That's what the point of the fourth step is. That's the point of the fifth step. This book is consistent from the first page to the last page as to what the goal is in here, what we're trying to do in order to experience that new freedom and that new happiness. So I guess the eighth step must have something to do with that relationship and that new freedom. It says, we have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. We're going to cast these things out because they block out the sunshine of the Spirit. Then we'll have a better relationship with him. Going on to past the fifth step. At the end of the fifth step into the sixth step and seventh. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Okay? You know, this is an instructional manual. You know, we just read a book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. If you do what we did, you'll get what we said we got. Now, what they did was not read this book, quite frankly. Because when they wrote this book and they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path in the last 4 years, they didn't have this book in the last 4 years. They read the Bible. So the truth is, if you really want to do what they were doing, you should be reading and studying the Bible. But I'm not even telling you to do that. Forget about that. Just read what they say to do. Just read the book. You don't have to read. If that ticks you off or whatever it is, You know what they say, whenever you disturb them, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. But, you know, that's just the truth of the matter. The truth of the matter is what they did was they read the Bible. And if you read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, if you read that, they'll say that certain sections of the Bible, like 1 Corinthians 13, James, the book of James, and Sermon on the Mount, they considered it absolutely essential. But forget that. If you're just not ready, if that's just driving you off the wall, just read what they say we're agreed to in the book. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to England to get it, then you're willing to take certain steps. Now, here's the instructions. Here's the steps in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know him better. Now, you can take that and put it in a wearing blender, mix that up, you know, with some scotch or whatever you want to do, and make it say anything you want, okay? You know, I prefer not to fool around with stuff anymore. I prefer to see things the way things really are and not to play games and rationalize. In other words, tell myself rational lies just because that's the way I want things to be. I prefer to follow directions and be obedient and follow the instructions rather than do the things I want to do, because that's willfulness, okay? And I see what it says here. It says, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. I don't know if you read those first five proposals that God thinks like a big deal. Omitted anything, for we are building, here it goes, the arch for which we shall walk a free man at last. That arch for freedom. That's what they're talking about. That's the arch you're building that you're going to walk through, because that arch leads to the stone crabs. It does. Which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? I mean, have we played around with this thing so that it sort of looks good on the outside, but it's not going to last? It's not going to last for 20 or 30 years, and it's not going to get us to where we want to go. It's not going to get us to experiencing much of heaven and being rocked to the fourth dimension of existence. Then it says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step six, which has to do with willingness to remove all these things, and then it talks about six and seven. We talked about that last week. In the seventh step prayer, which has to do with humility, gaining more humility. And then we get to step eight. And in step eight it says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. That's a quote from the book of James. Let's look at steps eight and nine. We have a list of all persons we had harmed and whom we are willing to make amends. That was taken from our four-step list. But we'll now find there's even more people on that list, and I'm going to talk about that in a few moments. Probably there are still some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. It says, to some people, it talks about talking to various people and how should we do it, and it says, at the moment, and this is about step eight, you know what we said about step four, about step five, about step six, all the steps having to do with relationship with God and doing God's will and staying close to Him and doing what His work. Here's step eight. Here's what it says. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. That's what you are trying to do that. We're all trying to put our lives in order. But, this is not an end in itself. This is not the end. This is not the purpose of this. Our real purpose, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That's the real deal. I read this poem from time to time, The Man and the Guy in the Glass, and I'm going to read it again in a few moments, but with maybe a different connotation having to do with the eighth step. I don't know what freedom means to you. And I'm not, I think there's various degrees of freedom. I'm not even saying I'm free yet. I think freedom is relative. I'm freer than I was 10 years ago, and 5 years ago, and 15 years ago. But there's some more freedom out there for me to grab, because the closer I get to Him, the freer I am. Because in our 12 and 12, it says true independence, true freedom has to do with total dependence upon God. And I'm not even saying I'm totally dependent upon God. You know, because sometimes I look to idols and things and other stuff going on, and I get distracted by worldly clamors, just like Bill Wilson, just like everybody else, all the TV, all the stuff, you know, all the stuff that's around you, distracting you and everything like that, making you look at other things and judge yourself by other ways. You know, but I want to talk a little bit about that freedom they're talking about and how I got that and how it comes upon you. I don't know what freedom is, but I know about the voices. So, what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous? I found that, you know, if I think, you know, that we're more alike than we are different. You know, I've talked about this before. I mean, you know, you walk in Alcoholics Anonymous thinking you're so unique. You know, nobody's like you. Nobody, you wouldn't understand. I mean, I know you think you understand me. But, I know you think you know what my problem is. But if you knew the little nuances, if you knew the little thing, if you knew about my divorce, if you knew about my mother, if you knew about my upbringing, if you knew about... If you knew about the wrinkles, every time I tried to start off and doing the right thing and I was screwed by somebody else, if you knew about all the stuff, then you'd understand that I may look like I have a drinking problem, but I don't have a drinking problem. I just drink because I have problems. And pretty soon, as a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems, you know what I mean? And pretty soon my problems are going to go away and I won't have to drink anymore, so thank you for your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself, you know, and something like that, you know? Yeah, I mean, I'm just unique with a capital U. And somewhere along the line, after coming to these meetings for months and years and everything, you understand. You just come to understand that you're not unique. there are other people like you. There's a few other people like you. And then after about 30 years, you understand that which I understand, that everybody's like you. That nobody's different. That deep down inside, the bottom line is it's the same deal. Yeah, it's the same thing. There's nothing original in here. It's been going on for a long time. There's really no original. So the chances are that if you felt a certain way, you know, other people have felt a certain way. So I just, as an example, want to talk a little bit about the voices. I know I'm talking about something that you guys probably don't have, but I want to talk about the voices. You know, that's sort of like when you're in the shower, or maybe you're washing yourself, and all of a sudden you hear, you know, you're an asshole. You know, so you turn around. Sure, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like, but, you know, you're a jerk. You don't deserve to live. Nothing's ever going to go right for you. You're a total screw-up. Why don't you kill yourself, you know? I mean, you know, that. You think that's funny, Jimmy. You're laughing at me, you know? Well, you got 20 years. You don't have that, you know? You hear those voices, you know, and you turn around to see who's talking to you, and there's nobody in the shower but you. You know, and you know, I mentioned a few voices, but you guys know there's a million different voices. There's stuff I haven't even talked about. You'll never get that job. You'll never get ahead. You're always going to be a loser. You're always going to be alone. It's those voices that are just ripping you apart and tearing you down and telling you that you're nothing. And, you know, those voices come. It don't even matter whether you're not drinking. It don't even matter whether you're sober. You're just hanging around doing nothing. You're not hurting anybody. And those voices are just coming. Now, and they're just there. And you don't even know where they come from, and you can't even stop them. You know, because they come like a thief in the night. You know, they're like hiding behind a rock somewhere, and then they just sort of jump out on you. And you want to know what the crazy thing about those voices? They come from a place. They come from a place. You know, people talk about the committee. Oh, I got the committee going on in my head. Let me tell you something. The committee that's going on in your head, the thousand voices that are going on all at the same time that you're listening to, that's driving you crazy, that is not the committee you have to worry about. Because you've been invited to their committee meeting. The committee you need to worry about is the executive committee that's meeting inside of you. And those are the guys that have not invited you to their session. Because that's where them voices are coming from. Out of nowhere, and you don't know where is this, whether you want to call it your subconscious, whatever, it's coming from some place that, because the bottom line is, those voices just don't come from nowhere. They don't come from Neptune. That stuff you tell yourself doesn't come from, you know, Kitchenetta. It comes from something that is deep down and putrid in you that no matter how long you're sober and how long you're not drinking, is always going to be there attacking you, accusing you, dragging you down. Unless you can figure out a way to get rid of it, and you want to know something that's harder, they're harder to get rid of than the booze. You're powerless over those voices. They arise from yourself and your selfishness and your disease. And from your humanity. And sometimes there seems no way of getting a handle on those voices. Or where they come from. Or why they come from. How can you ever be free? I'm not saying you can necessarily totally get rid of all those voices. They never happen. But you certainly can remove them to a great extent. How can you get free if you're walking around with those voices? And so that's the truth. You got to look at yourself in the mirror sometimes, and you got to say, you know, what's really going on here? You know, I got all this other stuff going on, and I'm sober, and I got a job, and I got this going on, but am I free? How am I experiencing much of heaven? Am I been rocketing the fourth dimension of existence? I've experienced this new freedom. Do I still have stuff going on that I'm not talking to other people about? I'm not even talking to myself about. I don't even know what it is, but there's something holding me back. There's something there that I can't get a grip on. When I was got divorced from my first wife, I had a son. His name was Andrew. Wonderful kid. He's like 34, 35 years old now. He lives in Tennessee with my daughter-in-law and two grandchildren. And he has a wonderful job, and he's just a great kid. And he's 6'6". And in any event, so I got divorced. He was like around 4 or 5 years old. And one day, you know, it was like a year after I got divorced, and, you know, they give you visitation, you know, and it was a Saturday, and I told them I was going to take them to the zoo. Now, my son was not on my four-step list. Because, you know, the four-step list, if you remember, is list. You start off with a list of resentments. And then after you do your list of resentments, there's three columns there. Then you say to yourself, okay, notwithstanding, you know, what they did to me, you would disregard that entirely. What did I do to them? And you sort of think about where your faults were. And then there's a list of fears. And there's a list of problems as far as sexual exploits and things like that. But the bottom line is, the four-step list, at the point in time when I did the four-step list, had to do with people you didn't like, people you were mad at, people you resented. So my son was not on my list because I didn't resent my son. You know, I didn't. I wasn't mad at him. I didn't resent him or anything like that. So in any event, I had this visitation. I told my son, and I'm telling you a story, and it's a true story. But you know, the truth of the matter is, as I tell you this, you know, the problem is about being an alcoholic is sometimes you don't remember things real well. You know, when things came crashing down on me and I finally made amends to my former wife about drinking, you know, somebody asked me a question. Had your wife, remember that story I tell, some of you know about, where my wife says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you? You know, one guy asked me one time, is that the first time she ever mentioned you drinking to you? And I said, I think so, I can't remember. Now the truth of the matter is, yeah, you know, I mean, the truth of the matter is, that was probably the 3,000th time, you know what I mean? But I honestly can't remember. But you know, the truth is this, you can somehow see by a certain vignette in somebody's life, if this is what happened, if I'm telling you the truth about something that happened on one particular day, this probably characterizes what I was doing all along without even realizing it. Because when you're selfish and you're self-centered, and you're stepping out on the toes of others and you're hurting other people, and you don't really give a crap about anybody else, and not in a malicious way, that's only an alcoholic can say that, when you're stepping on people's toes and you're crushing them, and you don't give a crap about anybody, but not in a malicious way. Not because you're like a bad person. When you're raping, robbing, ripping, and burning down their houses and screwing them to the wall, but not because you're a bad person, you know, because you really have a good heart, you know what I mean? That's what my mother used to say to me, well, but he has such a good heart, you know what I mean? I think Hitler's mother probably said, yeah, but he's such a good boy, you know what I mean? Yeah, but, you know, 11 million people later, you know, it's... And that's the way alcoholics are. We rationalize. It's not the way we are. We hurt people. We rip them apart. But, you know, we don't really think about what we're doing or anything like that because we're not concentrating on them because... We're the only thing that's important, and they're not important. We're not even paying attention. You know, the only time we say we're sorry, we don't really mean we're sorry. It's not like we're sorry. It's not like we did anything wrong. I'm sorry because, you know, if the person we'll hold the resentment for 20 years if you look at me funny. But if I rape your wife and kill your dog, and I say, I'm sorry I raped your wife and killed your dog, and you even look at me funny, I'm saying, what's the problem? I said I was sorry. In other words, I'm not really sorry. When I say I'm saying I'm sorry, that's so you will say I forgive you. Because you're not allowed to be mad at me. That's so I won't have to feel guilty and bad about myself, and then voices will come back, you know? So in any event, the point of the matter is, so we got some weird way of thinking and perceiving these things. This is the way alcoholics think and perceive about things. So, you know, I'm telling you this episode that I remember. I'm not telling you about the 50 episodes I don't remember. So on this particular Saturday, I was going to pick up my son and Andrew, and he was like, whatever, 6, 7 years old, and I told him I was going to take him to the zoo, and I fully intended to take him to the zoo. I had been out with Sally the night before, and we'd had a good time, and I woke up Saturday morning, and I was going to go and pick up my son at 10 o'clock and take him to the zoo. He was waiting for me by the window and to pick him up, take him to the zoo, and Sally at 9:30 called me up and said, hey, Russell, me and the girls are going out on the boat. Would you like to come along? So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking here. Now, here's the deal. This is a real dilemma. I'm thinking the boat, Sally, booze, the girls, you know, maybe sex or something like that. And then there's my son. You know, and I'll tell you, I thought about that it must have been about 15 seconds. And it was anchors away. It wasn't even, and I was cold stone sober. I mean, I wish I could say alcohol made me do the things I did. I wish I could blame alcohol for the crap I did for people. Most of the times I hurt people, really hurt people, I did it cold stone sober. And the only thing alcohol did was allow me to live with my sorry ass while I was screwing people up. That's the only thing it allowed me to do, and feel sorry for myself. And I've heard many people, after coming to AA, sober the same way without the booze. So I don't bullshit myself into believing I'm basically a good person, and I'm not selfish, and I'm a nice guy, except when I drink. I don't bullshit me with, and at least that's my deal, okay? I made that decision cold stone sober. And I didn't even call my son up. You know, because you know why? Because like I said to my sponsor, I feel guilty. He says, because you are. Oh, he'll be okay. And I start saying to myself things that alcoholics say to. What do alcoholics say to themselves, you know? Oh, he'll do better without me. He wouldn't like being with me. He'd rather be with his mother. It'd be a boring, you know, I'm actually doing him a favor. I don't know how alcoholics can do this, but we have a funny way of twisting things, you know, like somehow we're actually doing a good thing. And so I'm out in the boat, and I'm drinking this booze, and I'm thinking about what a great guy I am, and you know what I am? Deep down inside, I'm just a bum. I'm just a bum, because that's the way bums live. Being irresponsible and hurting other people. That's the way bums are, and that's what I was. I may have had a three-piece suit and a white shirt and a red tie and may have been a lawyer, but I was just a bum on the streets because that's the way I treated people and that's the way I acted towards people. When my son became 19 years old, he wrote me a letter. And in the letter, what he said was he no longer wanted me as a father. Now, I want to tell you something. I paid child support on time. I think most of the time, all the way up to him, I paid for his college. You know, we went on trips together and everything. And this letter to me came out of the blue. Out of the blue. I couldn't even imagine why this letter came. I thought I was a great dad. And he went through a whole list of things. And my kid's a great kid. Whole list of things of why he felt I wasn't really a good father. And he just mapped them out. And it had to do with a lot of the stuff I'm talking about. Being selfish, self-centered, really not really devoting any time to him. And he really had a great stepfather. Thank God for that. A non-alcoholic guy who paid attention to him. And, you know, so, and he wrote me this thing, and he said, as a matter of fact, he wasn't going to keep my name, my last name. He was going to change his name to his stepfather's name. My wife went crazy. She went, you know something? I didn't. It didn't even matter wrong, right, or whatever the deal was, you know. It didn't really matter, you know, because I just decided I was going to love on him. I decided he was right and I was wrong, and it didn't even matter anymore. It didn't even make sense to me. And the only thing my basic position was every opportunity I could get, I was going to show him how much I loved him. And he lived all the way either in New York or someplace else or in different places he was traveling around. But whenever I could get an opportunity to talk to him, I'd just end the conversation by telling him how much I loved him, asked him how he was doing, and everything like that. And I never brought that letter up to him. I never criticized him for it. I never argued with him about it. Never did any of my stuff. You know, my wife, my lovely wife, was always behind me. You know how they are. You ought to do this. You shouldn't take that line down. You're a great father, you know. You know, that's okay. I'll handle it. And you know that sort of thing, and it caused a certain amount of acrimony and stuff like that with my other kids and stuff. And the deal is, my amends to my son, if you want to talk about my, and he had to go on my list. He had to go on my eighth step list. He had to go as one of those people on my eighth step list, and that may not have even been on my first eighth step list. Maybe it was later on, but the fact of the matter is, and my amends to him was just trying to be the most decent guy I could be to him. And try to be understanding and loving with him. Now my relationship with my son is wonderful today. With him and his my daughter-in-law. And we're leaving on Thursday. I'll be back here next Tuesday for 4 days. We're going up to Knoxville, Tennessee, and we're staying in his house. We do this every year. I'll be with him and his wife and my two grandchildren. And of course, and we're going to have a great time. And I'm flying my father in. And of course, and this took, I want to tell you something. This didn't happen like in a week. I was nice for a week, or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We're talking like 7 or 8 years for him to warm up and come around, and then 8 years, 9 years, 10 years, and now we have a wonderful relationship. Now, you know, unfortunately, there will always be something there separated because that's what divorce does and everything like that. But our relationship is solid now. He respects me. I respect him. I love him. He loves me. He calls me up on the phone. We talk to each other. I visit him. And he's a wonderful son, and it's as good a relationship as I could have, and I'm proud of him. You know, and I don't have, and you know what I understand now, and this is sort of like a sort of like, and then what happened to me with some of the other amends I did, you know, and some of the other stuff I did, and you know, one of the lines that in there's a great line. I talked about self-pity the other day. I don't know whether it's in the seventh step or the sixth step or whatever it is. I did a little talk about self-pity because I was a self-pityaholic. There's a great line from 2 Corinthians where the Apostle Paul says the following. It says, godly sorrow brings repentance and leads to salvation and leaves no regret. But worldly sorrow brings death. And what he's talking about there, in my estimation, is the difference between feeling sorry for yourself and get into just an incredible degree of self-pity. You know, maybe you hurt somebody, maybe you did something wrong, and maybe, you know, somebody suffered, and because of that they're not calling you, or there's a broken relationship out there. Maybe it's with your mother, maybe it's with your father, maybe it's with your brother, maybe it's with your sister, maybe it's your wife, your ex-wife. There's something that's damaged out there, maybe it's with your kids. There's something totally broken and smashed, and you know you're the one who's broke it, and you're the one who smashed it, and you're the one who ruined it, and you're the one who screwed the whole thing up, and so you're feeling sorry for yourself. And so you're feeling sorry for yourself that your wife isn't calling you, or your ex-wife won't let you see the kids. My ex-wife won't let me see the kids, the bitch. So you're feeling sorry for yourself. You know, my boss who I stole money from won't talk to me. So you're feeling sorry for yourself. You know, my son won't talk to me. So you're feeling sorry for yourself. So you have all these broken relationships around, all these people that you're ignoring. You see them on the street and you cross over to the other side. You cross over to the other side and you say, I hope he doesn't see me. I hope he didn't see me. I hope I don't run into him. All these people that you hope you don't run into. Or you think, what do I do if I run into him? I can't go to that party because he'll be there. I can't go to that function because what if so-and-so shows up? All those places you can't go. All those things you can't do because he might or she might show up. Is that a freedom? What a crappy way to live. What a crappy, because you feel sorry for yourself. That's the kind of worldly sorrow they're talking about. That kills you and leads to death. That's the stuff, by the way, that has to do with those voices. That has to do with those voices. You know, that same voice that's telling you, don't go to that function, don't go there because he or she might be there, that makes you look, that's the same voice that comes up in the middle of the night and says you're an asshole. That's the same voice and it comes from the same place. Unless you get rid of that other deal, that problem you have with him, you ain't going to get rid of that voice. You know, and as a matter of fact, in Sermon on the Mount, the book that the old timer said you're supposed to read, it says if you have something to bring to your father, if you have a sacrifice to bring to your father, bring to God, you know, and you have something, your brother has something against you, hey, you leave your sacrifice there and you go fix up with your brother, then come back to God, or else you're blocked off. It's all scriptural. It's all there. This stuff wasn't made up. And what I have found is you know, imagine what it would be to be a person. I'm not saying you guys. Maybe there's one of you guys in the audience. I know I was one of these who really felt that he had screwed his entire life up. Imagine you're a person who felt that you had screwed his entire life up, or at least his life up in a bunch of areas with a whole bunch of different people, beyond repair, that there was no way of repairing it. And imagine one day, after you've lived for years, feeling that you have totally screwed up your life in this area with all these people, and it was never going to be okay again. No matter how sober you were, it was never going to be okay. Imagine one day God came down and said, listen, I've made it all right. And you knew it was all perfect again. It was all clean. There were no problems. You no longer had to worry about going there. You no longer had to worry about showing up there. You no longer had to worry about running into this person or running into that person. You never had bad thoughts about any of those areas. All of a sudden, the voices started going away. What would your life be like? Would that make your life better? Would that be a better way of doing things? You think that would help with your sobriety? You think it would help with your relationship with God? Well, the eighth and ninth step, that's the start. That's what these deals are about. You know, I could tell you how to do the steps. Why should I tell you that? It's in the book. You can talk to your sponsor how to do the steps. How to make a list. I can tell you how to do the steps and do all that stuff. What I really want to talk to you about is the power that's unleashed and what's going to happen in your life and what you're going to experience when you do these steps. And of course, I'm going to say, because of my opinion, when you do these steps, would you focus on your relationship with Him? Because there's something else, there's something that mixes in when you're doing these steps, because you're doing it not only for yourself, but you're doing it to please Him, to get closer to Him, because of relationship with Him, because you want to do His, get close to Him and do His work well, and you know, this is what He wants to do. There's something miraculous. How about this? You get a new freedom, you get a new happiness. You experience much of heaven, you get rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. You see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. It's unbelievably spectacular. It's like Stone Crab City. It's unbelievable. So that's what you want to do. A step. Thank you very much.
Another meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous.